Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith. Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by muscly Max Montana. And I say that because I saw him doing some T-bar rows out in the garage earlier today, so he's got a full pump on for the episode, in case you couldn't tell.
Zoom in here, Shorty. Zoom in on that. Photoshop a vein down there for me.
Old cock arms Ada. And our guest today, weightlifting coach extraordinaire, Mr. Sean Waxman. Sean, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you very much for joining us. So Sean's got a long history as a lifter and a coach in USAW, coached a lot of very strong athletes, had kind of a unique position. One of the first times that Max and I probably hung out very much was at the Klokov Ilya seminar back in the day. Yeah. So this unique position dealing with foreign athletes and foreign coaches. So we're excited to talk to him about his coaching pedigree, some of his thoughts on how this information from foreign lifting systems can be utilized, and some ideas about long-term development, long-term planning for athletes. So let's just go ahead and jump right into it. So Sean, could you tell us a little bit about, for the people who aren't familiar with you, your history as a lifter, how you came to be a coach and some of your influences as a coach?
My lifting career was fairly uneventful. I was okay. I got into it actually to become a strength coach. I wanted to learn. I decided early on that the snatch, clean and jerk was the thing that I wanted to base my training of athletes on, and all the exercises that lead up to developing it. So I said, well, I'm an immersive kind of guy. So if I want to learn something, just throw myself into it. And I said, I'll be a weightlifter so I can learn. And then I'll use those skills to use it in strength and conditioning. So that's how I kind of started in weightlifting.
But what age was that?
Well, made that decision probably 22, 23. Oddly enough, though, before that, my introduction to weightlifting at all, the movements themselves, was through physical therapy. I had Rob Panarello was my physical therapist for my shoulder. My shoulder done in college, and the bridge between therapy and actual play, the exercises we use more dynamic exercises. One of them being the power clean. So I had a physical therapist actually teach me how to do a power clean. Huh. And he was a strength coach for the Giants. I mean, he was under Johnny Parker. So he was he knew what he was doing. And so that was actually my first introduction to weightlifting. And then the more I learned, the more I realized that I wanted to use weightlifting, and I became a weightlifter and competed from 93, 92, 93 to 2001, I think it was. After that, it was it for me. I wasn't going to get any better, and I was going to kill myself, I think, if I continued. So I trained with Bob Tacano only, and throughout my career, and it was an interesting experience. We both are bio majors, and so he was really generous with his time with me, as far as learning coaching and science of coaching. And so and the training was we trained every day, 6 days a week, 48 weeks a year. I think I missed 9 days of training in 8 years. So it was, and it was, I mean, brutal. I wouldn't recommend that kind of, I mean, he's changed since then, but it was really, I mean, I've talked to Max about it. You're squatting every day, multiple times a day sometimes. It taught me how to be a level of toughness that I didn't know that I had. But the biggest value that I got from that is the conversations with Bob. Mm-hmm. I would show up an hour before training, our scheduled training, and he was training high school athletes. And he allowed me to come and watch and ask and observe. And so that to me, like I had, like I was almost like a PhD in sports science. So I did that nearly every day, Monday through Friday. And I really am grateful for that. So
what is Bob's, who are his mentors? Where was his official kind of?
So, you know, like back in his day, there wasn't really coaches right. that much. So like Bob Heist III, like the okay. old man Heist who started Maverick Barbell. Tommy Kono was his idol, obviously, because right. they're both Japanese. But I don't know if he had a coach other than, I think Bob Heist III. But don't quote me on that.
Sure, sure.
But back then, a lot of those guys, they looked at strength and health, and they said, oh, there's the clean. It's like three pictures, and I'm going to try to do that. There was no, we have the luxury of the digital age.
Yeah.
But those guys didn't. So a lot of those guys are self-taught.
So where do you think Bob developed his kind of strategy and system of training from?
So Bob was, so from my understanding, Bob was very heavily Russian influenced
right.
early on, like everybody else. So they were really the only ones that were doing anything right. sports science wise. I don't know. And then I think that one of the biggest events that affected his trajectory was his time he spent in Bulgaria with Abajayev.
Right.
So he went, he went on a tour with, I think USAW set it up at the time, a couple weeks, I think, and he got to spend time with Abajayev. And I think that really altered his perception of what the human body could do.
Right.
Not, I don't know if he actually realized that those weren't really humans that were going through that.
One little asterisk there.
Right. So he didn't know, we didn't train Bulgarian style yeah. as far as singles to max all the time.
Right.
But the volume that we did, I think he said, you know, we have to elicit a certain amount of stress to the human sure. organism in order to force change. And his philosophy was, this is the volume that's gonna do it. Either, and this is what I think was, this is a very Bulgarian approach. He says, well, those that can do it are going to be great.
Yeah.
Those that aren't, you know, maybe you'll be good or maybe you'll be done. So I think that mentality of this is what it takes.
Yeah.
And I'm going to find the athlete that fits that. I'm not going to mold it to any particular athlete.
Right.
So that was the, and we had a couple of guys that went through it fine. Like I never understood. Like guys would be no problem. And here I am, you know, I'm dragging my ass trying to get through. Plus, I had come from football, so
yeah,
I was a little beat up going in. But that was his. That was the thing. Everybody did the same training. I don't know if he altered my training more than a couple of times in all the time I was there. And I think he told me to stop during a session, maybe once or twice. So it didn't matter if you make, miss. It just you just go. You grind.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So like I said, just learn how to be. And I did. You wind up doing a lot more than you think you can.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's the best approach.
There's something interesting as you say that, because it's definitely not the first time I've heard this, and I think Chad too, where these people will tell us about the training they did, even what I did and what Chad did when he was young. I'm sure what you did, like Adam Nelson, maybe one of the most insane ones, the like 10 sets of 10 on 5 exercises for a workout.
One workout?
Yeah. Like all leg stuff, right? And other things like squatting 7, 8, 10 times a day, like maximum every single day. These like ridiculous
wow.
training programs that for sure are not the smartest way to approach
no.
training. But there's like some, maybe it's like that's the kind of training you should do if you're going to be a great coach, because you're not going to be a great athlete out of it for some of us.
Right.
But you walk away with this perspective of like, well, okay, like you could do the shittiest version of a squat program ever and still squat 700 pounds. So
right.
there must
Adam
be...
Nelson was going to squat 700 pounds if he did,
right.
you know, aerobics.
Right. Well, or anyone, like, it's like, you might find that like, yeah, the whole the whole amount of training you can do, what's possible, what you're capable of, all these things kind of get, you know, maybe like a bigger perspective on the whole thing. And at the same time, doing that crazy training and that ridiculousness might actually open you up for the ability to do more later. If you had never been
right
pushed into that kind of work capacity, you might not be able to tolerate the loads necessary, you know, later on.
You might not be able to do a double day of Sheko. Just do the program twice a day.
Right.
No, I did, you know, when I was young, as soon as I touched a barbell, I tried to push myself. And I did, I don't know if you guys might be too young for this, but Cybergenics. Hmm. So it was basically a scam to sell these supplements that didn't work. But the workout, so it was positive and negative failure on everything.
Yeah.
So like you would squat to positive and negative failure.
To concentric and eccentric.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So you'd go. And then you pick yourself up out of the heap that you were in and then do jumps.
Oh, good Lord.
Plus, but then what happened when you took the supplements?
Well, of course, then you got all of a sudden supplements being stronger. So I did stuff like that. I saw an advertising for the strength shoes. You know, those platforms.
Chad's got a great strength shoes.
I bought them. I didn't take them off. I wore them everywhere. I just said, I want to jump higher. And I was pulling tires and anything that I can do. Jumping, I could find stuff. I could think I could jump off that. And I would jump off stuff. because I saw Stefan Furlholm. He's the biggest, stronger, faster, poster boy. And he was like a Swedish or something. Thrower.
I remember the posters of him hanging up in the high school.
So he would do. I saw an article of him doing a depth jump off this high wall. Oh my God! Because I wanted to look like him. He looked like an athlete, you know. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna do. I mean, I just put my body through everything.
I was big jump soles with an equivalent of strength shoes are the ones that I used. And I was a junior, senior in high school. I was over 250 pounds. And those are hundreds of contacts of high intensity stuff every day. And I'm surprised that I have Achilles left. But I don't think I'd last a day on them now. But so the point I want to dive deeper in, you mentioned this the Bulgarian tour and learning what they're doing, but maybe they're not humans, and that I think is such an important understanding. You know, American weightlifting, in my short time around it and learning about it, whether it's all right, let's bring in Dragomir, let's bring in Zygmunt, and not that those guys aren't good coaches or anything, but they're from different systems. And as the retroactive tests have shown, there's not everyone else is doing it, but everyone that it seems like, the weightlifting pundits are like, well, we need to do more Russian system or Bulgarian system or learn from the Chinese or learn from the Kazakhs or whatever. And you've gotten to spend time around, Russian coaches, Cuban, Chinese, all these different things. As you look at this idea of learning from foreign systems, where do you think the value is in that? And how do you think that Americans need to calibrate for the information?
It's a good question. And so I've been fortunate to really spend a lot of time with guys from coaches from other countries. And especially, in competitions, you get them a little oiled up and they start talking, and it's really, the conversations have been great, but so the one thing I've thought about this a lot, and because we all want a system, right? We want to look at it towards a system that works. But really, the essence of any system is process. So the thing that all of these countries have in common is they have a process, regardless of what it is, right? Drugs, no drugs, 10 times a day training, 3 times a week training, it doesn't matter. They have a system that they follow, and it allows them to look at what works and doesn't work and constantly try to improve and get rid of what doesn't work and add. So forget about, people have to look, they got to see the forest, through the trees. You got to see why are they successful? It can't be drugs, because almost every other country is taking drugs. So there's a better and a worse among those countries. Mm-hmm. So the thing that they all do is they all do the same thing for them. And I think that before we start the conversation about what countries or what systems work best, it's not the system, it's the process. And I think that we have to, as coaches, I don't think the United States is going to develop its own process. Mm-hmm. We're decentralized. It's not, and you're not going to, I mean, we all know this, you're not going to get a room full of coaches to agree on anything.
Well, it's kind of like, yeah, the letter I did 3 years ago now.
Yes.
Open letter to USA Weightlifting. Yeah. Talked about developing the American system in that, and that's what needs to be strived for, whether it's a pipe dream or not, is maybe a different discussion. But as we look at the changing landscape of international weightlifting, the drug tests are seemingly much more serious, mm-hmm. you know, and these countries are getting sanctions and everything, and you know, maybe they just keep doing what they're doing and they
right.
or they figure out a different way to beat the tests or something, but they don't change their training. The other option is they change the training in some way. And I think what we saw, you know, a lot with Dragomir and Zygmunt for his first couple of years was they brought the same system here, yeah. and it didn't work. No. The lifters just got too beat up because it was too much for them, because you know they weren't on drugs and they couldn't adapt the same way. You know, with something like the Russian system, what are adaptations that need to be made to the system to make it work for the drug-free weightlifter?
So I think, you know, the Russian system is a good baseline to look at because for a number of reasons. First is they use a variety of exercises. You know, I think that can't be overlooked as far as its importance. I think that there's a sequential order in which things are added. I think that they have a good process for development. Like their development from years 1 through 6 is really good, and I don't think we have to change actually that all too much. I think it's the five and six years on or when. I think you talk about once an athlete achieves technical mastery, I think, you know, that process that the Russians use is really good. I think once they've reached mastery, how do you get them to, you know, to be international master sport type athlete? That's where I think there's the big difference has to mm-hmm. come.
If you ever shower, brush your teeth, or try to make your hair look presentable, and hopefully you do all of those things, I've got good news for you. Dollar Shave Club has a lot of stuff to help you out. Even though I'm generally pretty well bearded, they have a lot of other stuff. My favorite is the Calming Amber Lavender Body Cleanser, and they have everything you need to help you get ready in the bathroom. Dollar Shave Club, yes, Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it, shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even a wipe that will leave your tush feeling tingly clean. All of Dollar Shave Club products are made with top shelf ingredients that won't break your budget and you'll feel the difference. Plus, shipping is included with your membership. Here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club products for just $5. You can get their Daily Essential Starter Set. Comes with Body Cleanser, One Wipe Charlies, their Amazing Butt Wipes, their World Famous Shave Butter, and their best razor, the 6-Blade Executive. Keep the blades coming for just a few more bucks a month. Add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need for the bathroom. Check it all out at dollarshaveclub.com/juglife. That's dollarshaveclub.com/juglife. Would you think that even in that developmental system, the developmental stage, years 1 through 6, typically when in a biological age is year 1 through 6
right.
happening, for a Russian weightlifter, so does the time become compressed?
Right.
Or and I want to get more into the kind of long-term development stuff later, but continuing with this current part of the discussion, what are the, you know, besides the process and the creation of a system, maybe some specifics that you've seen,
yeah, absolutely.
From some of these different national systems?
The big difference that we face as opposed to other countries is, when does an athlete insert themselves into weightlifting? Right? Mm. So you can have, in the Russian system, that 1 through 6, you know, that one, that first year is probably what, 10, 11, 12 years old. That's not the case generally in the United States. So the concept of this long, of this for 1 to 6 years is not really 1 to 6 years for us. Mm-hmm. So I think that you have to look at certain factors. Age is a size, physical, like physical education background. I think if you get an older, physically physically educated athlete that doesn't have any movement limitations, they can that they can enter into that second phase, that going through that first 1 through 6 quickly, mm-hmm. because their body is more conditioned to handle heavier loads. Their motor cortex is fully developed, so they can learn things quickly. I think you still have to be careful about how quickly you bring them through, because being strong and being durable for weightlifting are two very different things. Mm-hmm. So I think they're regardless of how talented the athlete is, how prepared, physically prepared they are, there still is a time period that you have to spend strengthening their connective tissue, strengthening their joints, in order for them to handle the heavy clean and jerks that later down the road. Regardless of you can have a gymnast that's a high level gymnast say, I'm done with gymnastics, I want to come to you. I still think you have to spend time with them. So I think my parameter is, in the switching from one phase to the next, I think the first phase is about technical mastery. The second phase is about strength. So the technical mastery phase ends when the mistakes that the athlete makes are not mistakes of poor concept of technique, but it's mistakes that they're just not strong enough to hold position.
Yeah.
So that's when one phase ends and the next phase begins. Right. And how long that takes, it's a guess, but you know, we talk about that one that 6 years. It could be 3, you know, depending upon if you get a mature athlete that has a good physical education and not any bad habits. That's the other mm-hmm. thing. You get a great athlete with that's been taught wrong.
Right.
Now you have to. You're not going to get perfect technique out of them. You have to get consistent technique out of them.
Do you think the problem exists where we all agree that there's two distinct phases? One is this development of technical mastery. The other is essentially an emphasis on competition results.
Right.
And do you think that in the United States, the problem is people don't have this concept that there's these two distinct phases to long-term development, and so it blends together where, like, we're going to develop technique and that in turn produces the competition results. Yeah. And so you get an athlete that comes in and it's like a short-term exploitation of their abilities, produces great results initially, which, you know, satisfies posting on Instagram, making medals, keeping them in the sport, getting everyone excited. But then the long-term ramifications are that they didn't develop
right.
a foundation so that they can't succeed. So you end up with lots of, you know, flash in the pan athletes and you know, potential talent that ends up, you know, making mistakes and errors that should have been eliminated years ago that now haunt them in the future.
Absolutely.
So it seems like that's our
that's our model,
right? Yeah.
And you know, I think that where we, like, to me, the first step, the first phase of all of this is the ability to teach rational technique.
Yeah.
Right. And we fail miserably with that. So that's the first thing that has to happen. You know, that's it. Nothing else matters.
Why do you think? Why do you think we struggle so much in that here?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things. So speaking with all these international coaches, these guys are professional coaches. They go to school to be a coach.
Yeah.
And then more specifically, they go to school to be a coach of weightlifting. I mean, I built that for myself. You know, I did all the science classes. I found somebody that I mentored under somebody that understood the science of lifting and coaching. And it was just the self exploring for me. There was no class, there was no program that I can go to
right.
learn this shit. But these guys, that's what they do. They go to school to learn how to be a coach. At first, you know, it's this big science background that everybody takes, and then it's a specialization.
Right.
I mean, we don't have that. So we got guys that we've been all people that are doing this because it's something that they're passionate about. And we have passion, but we don't have skill. So I don't know how, I don't know how to fix that. Because you can't, well, I know what I would do would piss a lot of people off, but, you know, that's never really bothered me before. But I just, you know, if you're really serious about developing coaches in a way to compete with other countries in a consistent basis, because right now we have a lot of talent.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if we don't have this talent? Then what happens? Are we developing anything? What's the process that we're using to continually develop this talent? So, like for me, USAW, instead of spending we're spending resources on focusing on the people that we have already. I should take that back. We should be focusing on coaching development,
yeah,
in a real way.
Yeah.
Because never mind the athletes so much. It's the coaches are the ones that are going to develop the talent. So if we don't have, we can do all the increased numbers that we want. You know, we can open up the floodgates. If tomorrow, you know, soccer was banned and swimming was banned and gymnastics was banned, and all these athletes are coming to USAW, what are we going to do with them?
Max out every day.
Right. Let's go. Max out.
Do it.
So what I'm saying is, you know, let's start now with a coaching development process.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean like you and I don't do the same thing.
Yeah.
But there's common threads. There's reasonable things that all coaches who are developing high level athletes do. It might look a little different, but we can have a conversation about coaching weightlifting or coaching the snatch, coaching the clean and jerk, and we can agree on very important things.
Yeah. How many of the, I feel like personally, the underpinnings of any coach, the underpinnings of coaching in general are understanding, obviously, communication and the social aspect of it, but understanding the principles of training. Right. And I would be curious to know how many coaches, you grab 10 random coaches off the street or at nationals, could really sit down and maybe not be able to write down an excellent definition of every principle, but even understand that, one, there are principles,
right,
and that there's underlying principles that exist, and those principles, you know, are saturate all training of every single sport, and could say, oh yeah, I can see how the principle of specificity applies to right. football, basketball, weightlifting, track and field. So I think like this like fundamental failure there, or just sort of lack of knowledge there, bleeds into everything that we do as coaches, or the U.S. does as coaches.
And to that same effect, you know, I see it in powerlifting, and the way I've described it before is you get these great lifters, exceptionally talented lifters, and if you ask them to coach you, and it's, you know, why just someone with a big total doesn't make a good coach. Mm-hmm. They might understand their program,
yes,
yeah,
but they don't understand programming.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and an important distinction to be made there. And I think is, you know, if weightlifting coaches are just regurgitating the same program that they trained under or whatever without an understanding of more of the why behind the what that they're doing, that it's going to become limited. And if they get an athlete who fits it right, maybe that yeah. person becomes very, very talented. But I definitely agree with you on the coaching development side of things, because an athlete maybe has, you know, 2 to 8 year, you know, strong competitive career. But, you know, we got to sit down with Tim Swords a couple of weeks ago. And if you have a great coach like a Tim Swords type, he may be in the sport for 40 years,
right?
You know, and how many yeah. athletes
yeah.
could he bring to that high level within that 40-year career. So I do think that that's a big thing. And if I see somewhere, you know, where USA Weightlifting could do a better job is educating the youth coaches and junior coaches.
Yeah.
Because information about the training of senior athletes is so much more prevalent.
Right.
And all the, when people talk about Russian system, Chinese system, Bulgarian system, they're talking about not the first 1 to 6
year phase. 6 to 12.
Yeah, it's the 6 to 12 year phase. Yeah. And if the coaches who are working with the youth athletes and junior athletes don't understand that that is a, you know, a latter stage of things and try and apply it too early, that's, I think, what really hamstrings the long-term progress is that lack of the early developmental stage.
I agree.
So as we look at long-term development for the athlete, and where it's tough, you know, where it's more complex for the American lifter, mm-hmm. is you get some people who start when they're 12, and you get some people who start when they're 22, and both of them have been very successful relative to the American lifters. You know, Morgan King going to the Olympics, and she started at what, 26 or 27. You know, if you look at those two cases, someone coming into the sport as a youth, someone coming in as a senior athlete with whatever sport background they have, and I know there's a lot of variables here. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the first thing to focus on? Technical development.
Always going to be technical development,
right?
Because that's what everything is built on. So, and I mentioned this before. I said, you know, if you get somebody that has bad habits or limitations that aren't going to get fixed, then you have to develop a stable technique. You know, with somebody that is younger and has none of these problems, then you look at, like, you know, what's the rational technique for weightlifting? So rational technique might not be, rational technique is stable, but stable technique might not be rational technique. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just this kind of weird thing. So once you develop a consistency, then you can, and that's when you can kind of, that's the first step, whatever that looks like. And understand that if it's a stable technique but not perfect, then you're going to have limitations. You don't know what those limitations are until you get there. Because at some point, biomechanics is going to bite you in the ass. You know, if you have somebody that can't straighten their arms and overhead, it's going to be difficult for them to hold jerks overhead at some point. You know, and it's because they just don't have the good position.
So that's actually really interesting, because that's something that I've... So you're saying that two different athletes, you have two different roads, basically. You have an athlete who's a beginner that comes in. You're going to teach them an ideal technique that models or mimics the model of you know, let's say the most efficient, excellent technique that you would pick from a model that was developed based on biomechanics and logic.
Absolutely.
Another athlete comes in, maybe already has some training under their belt or athletic career under their belt. They are more advanced in age. It's going to be more difficult to change the technique they have. It might have some flaws that are not modeled in, don't mimic the model you have. But you can stabilize the technique so it's repeatable and safe, and you'll go with what that is. And then the goal is, well, let's achieve what we can physically out of this person. So you would say those are two different paths you have to follow as a coach.
Yes, I mean, and you know, to use myself as an example, when I came into Takano, I was like 23 or 24,
right.
Really good athlete. I mean, over 10-foot vertical broad jump. You know, over 35-inch vertical. So, I mean, I was already a good athlete.
Yeah.
But I was 24.
Right.
You know, we don't have time to fuck around.
Yeah.
So that's part of the reason why he kind of threw me into the mix. Because he figured I was a good enough athlete, I'll pick it up, and I'll be able to withstand it. So, like, if you have, you know, time is a factor, too. Because this shit takes time. You know, you have a lot of time when someone's 12 to get to hold their hand and get them through. But if you have an athlete that's 25, 26 years old, I mean, you got to get them stable and you got to go, because you'll have maybe one chance.
Yeah, it's like you don't have time to necessarily do what is optimal.
Right.
You know, all thing like optimal with everything else being equal, you have to do what's optimal for the actual situation. And if you have someone who's, you know, has 4 year, you know, a potential 4 year career.
Right. What are you going to do?
Yeah. You have to.
You spent 4 years perfecting.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen. And
you pull the straight arms, but you only clean 90 kilos.
Right. Yeah. So, like, other countries don't deal with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're 24 years old, you don't even have a chance.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is where the U.S., I think, is ahead of the game in a sense of, you know, I think in this next couple of quads, we're going to have athletes that didn't start until late that are going to be medal contenders. So
you once told me a story about a Russian coach telling you that you had asked him, hey, like, what's the progression for teaching snatch in Russia? And you know, this is really common in the U.S., this idea of, like, here's our snatch technique model, here's our progression. And part of that probably comes from, you know, capitalism. You know, we have to sell, you're selling a product, so you create a system for teaching it. And I think it's a good thing to have a uniform structure to, like, hey, here's how you do it. What did he tell you that they do in Russia? What is the progression for teaching in Russia?
I forgot.
I remember you said he was like, we don't. Every kid in Russia knows what a snatch is when they come into the gym.
Right. Yeah, it's a different. The entry into weightlifting is just different in the United States than anywhere else.
Yeah.
It's just.
Well, it's like, you know, in America, baseball or basketball.
Yeah.
You know, I think I probably started playing basketball in a little rec league or whatever. I was 6 or 7 years old. But I'd been playing in my driveway before that.
Right.
Yeah.
And the first time I shot a basketball, you know, it's not like I just grabbed this basketball and looked at the basket like, how does it go from here to there?
Yeah.
You know, I had seen ESPN, I'd seen Michael Jordan, I'd seen and you could recreate it to some degree, and you'd seen people swing a baseball bat, and maybe you didn't do it perfectly right, but it's like, all right, that's some facsimile of what we're going to try and do. Now let's tweak it and tweak it and tweak it. Where, you know, people hadn't seen a snatch till they're 22, you kind of, and the people who are talented and have the aptitude for it, they're going to be able to see it happen and make it look like, okay, that is a snatch, maybe not a very good one, but we got something to work with.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, quads and America over the next several quads, and the idea of the quadrennial, the 4 year training plan, the Olympic period, I think doesn't get enough attention in the long the planning for lifters.
People are thinking about next week.
Yeah, and some of it I think is problematic, or is just a symptom of the way that qualifying for international teams works here. You know, you can't have an Ilya situation where he's like, okay, I'm just not going to compete for this year, and we had one guy do that. Kendrick Ferris did, and he went to 3 Olympics. You know, through this longer development plan. But if a coach is trying to plan long term for their athlete, you know, a year at a time, 4 years at a time, what are some early considerations in that versus, you know, when it really counts considerations?
You're talking about like more high level athletes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think the most important thing, which is what this part of it drives me crazy, and it's not USAW's fault, is what's the 4 year competition schedule. You know, when are the major competitions? That to me is the first thing you have to identify. And then which of those competitions are important that you have to be able, you have to be in peak shape. Like for athletes that already put up a big total at Worlds, for us, Pan Am's wasn't that important because they're already going to be on the world team for next year.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, the training would reflect that. It wouldn't be a major peak. So you have to.
Well, I mean, Worlds last year doesn't count for Worlds qualifying.
Does
that change?
Does it?
Yeah. Well,
you sure?
According to.
Is that a new calendar?
Oh, right.
It did prior.
It did prior, but it
prior
it
years,
doesn't,
yeah.
doesn't
yeah.
this year. Right. This time. Sorry. But right. So let's scratch that. So, I forgot the new weight classes are
after
are
you
happening.
Photoshop those bicep veins and you want to.
But I think identifying the major competitions are the first thing you have to do. And then, you have to see what are the, initially, you know, what are the problems we have to solve right away? Like, how do we get, we're here, we need to, we want to get here, you know, what do we have to do? What are the, what's the big picture stuff that we have to do? We have to, what's the total? And then we say, okay, how do we, what do we need to do to get to that total? So what are the things that are the barriers in our way that are preventing us from getting there? And then you start to kind of peel back these layers. Well, it's, you know, the snatch is low. Okay, well then how do we, what are the milestones that we have to reach in order to get there? So we have this long-term, I mean, it's like anything with planning. We have this long-term goal. We know what the destinations are that we have to go to. And then we have to know what are the things that we have to bring with us to those destinations. And that's really the, as far as, you know, the 5,000 foot view, that's what we're looking at doing. And, you plan it as if it's a perfect situation without injury, without life, shit getting in your way, which we all know that doesn't ever happen. Mm-hmm. But we have to have an idealized model first. And then from that idealized model, the one thing that we do know, regardless of what bullshit happens in between, we know where we do definitely know what we have to do to get to where we have to go. So within those periods of time, if shit happens, then on the fly, we got to figure out how do we, what alterations do we have to make in order to stay on track? Mm-hmm. So it becomes this constant influx. It's like a biological organism because it's constantly affected by its external stress.
And I think that's where the understanding of principle becomes so important, because if you just have this very rigid plan, and when something inevitably goes wrong in it, if you don't understand the why behind that plan, or you can't contextualize that you're going to, you know, this adjustment I make, yeah, maybe I have to give up a little bit of specificity for extra variation because they're getting stale, or is this injury workaround or whatever, it makes it very difficult to make those decisions. And I think this is something that definitely exists in the long term for the athletes as well as the shorter term. And you know what I'd encourage coaches and lifters to do there, if you work with youth athletes, and this is the one that is more like sensitive to mm-hmm. me, because I don't want to see a youth athlete go down a path that or their coach take them down a path that they think is good in the time because they're getting these good quick results and actually end up limiting their long-term potential, is that if you work with a 13-year-old lifter, 13-year-old athlete in any sport, your concern cannot be, what do I do to become the best 13-year-old?
Right. Yeah.
It is, what can I do at 13 to set me up for becoming the best 23-year-old?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Or if you're, you know, you've been weightlifting for a year or 2 years, it's not necessarily how can I, you know, make the biggest total possible at American Open Series 1.
Right.
You know, it's how can my training for American Open Series 1 help me lift more at American Open Championships at the end of the year? And I think that's where it gets lost, is people are thinking in 8 weeks and 12 weeks and 16 weeks at a time, you know, just how can I make the biggest results at this next meet, not with the context of some stuff is more important than others. Some meets are more important than others. And you can't, if you're trying to always peak or you're trying to always have your best meet ever, you know, once you have some appreciable qualification, it just can't happen like that. Or instead of the peak being, you know, instead of getting to have one or two meets a year up here, now you have three or four or five meets a little bit lower.
That's exactly right. It's the, you know, one eye on what's going on right now and responding and reacting to that. But the other eye's got to be in what's the ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then what decisions we make to get there are, you know, part art and part science. You know, it's getting an athlete to that point is nothing short of a miracle.
Yeah. And it's when there's so many qualifying meets mm-hmm. and there's stipends and all this different shit, it makes it very cloudy and complicated, I think, to create that long-term plan. But when you mentioned that in there, art and science, and something I think that you're well known for is you provide this on your website, and I think really gets to that issue of the art versus the science of coaching is the idea of lifting ratios.
Yes.
And comparing the different exercises in this, you know, Vitruvian man type of idyllic proportion. Can you talk about, you know, what the, you know, what they are, how you use them, how people can apply them?
So this is a big part of my process, right? So I look at the relationship between the snatch, clean and jerk, and all the other lifts. So we have it's about 12 lifts or so that I look at for the clean and jerk supplemental exercises, lifts from boxes, lifts from the hang, press, and all these different exercises. And the snatch is, I think, 5 or 6 exercises that I feel are the most impactful for improving and developing the snatch and a clean and jerk.
So before we get into that, not to cut you off too much.
No problem.
But for so these other ones would be defined as special exercises.
Special exercise. Anything that's not a snatch or clean and jerk is a special exercise.
So to prove a point to powerlifters who probably don't actually listen to this podcast because they hate me, you said 5 or 6 exercises for the snatch. Can you tell us what those exercises are?
Yeah, off the top of my head, overhead squat, snatch from the blocks above the knee, hang snatch from below the knee. There's some kind of
like a snatch grip push snatch press. Grip
press or something like that. I think those are the general ones. There might be snatch from the block below the knee, which I'm not sure has a strong correlation. I'm still deciding that. It's a great training exercise to reduce some of the stress on the back and the legs, but I don't know if it correlates well to performance in the competition.
So, to make my somewhat sarcastic point here, you're concerned that snatch from blocks below the knee may not have a high enough transfer to training.
Right.
So that's the type of scope we're talking about when defining a special exercise.
Yes.
You know who I'm talking to. Okay? That the most dissimilar exercises there was like an overhead squat was as far away as we were getting. That's what special exercises actually are.
I'm glad I could help you.
Yes, thank you. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like our podcast. Listen wherever you want when it's convenient for you. Did you know that you can also get postage on demand? All you need is stamps.com. We use stamps.com to ship books and shirts and dozens, if not hundreds, of packages a day to get out to all of you guys, our great listeners. And they've been great for growing our business and so simple to use. With stamps.com, you can access all the services of the post office right from your desk. Buy and print real U.S. postage for any letter or any package, all available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just click, print, mail, and you're done. Stamps.com will even send you a digital scale. You can weigh all your letters and packages and print the exact amount of postage you need every time. Right now, you can use Jug Life for this special offer and a 4-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone at the top right corner of the homepage and type in Jug Life. That's stamps.com and enter Jug Life. Thank you. Continue. So we have the your snatch exercise, your clean and jerk exercise.
And so, and including in those exercises, back squat, front squat, obviously. And so I look at what these exercises are, and that tells me either where the weakness is and where we need to concentrate the training. So how I use this also is, you know, I use strength as a driver for the clean and jerk. So I don't try to push the clean and jerk until the squat is higher enough above the clean and jerk in order to push. Because I think that, to me, back squat between 120, 130% of the clean and jerk is ample strength to be able to recover and not to beat the shit, not always operating on the red line. So if your squat is, let's say, 150% of your clean and jerk, well, that tells me the focus doesn't have to be on improving leg strength. We can focus more energy on development of special strength in different positions.
Once I get that like 370 kilo clean.
Yeah, but you, right.
370 clean coming up.
My ratios are off.
My ratios are a little off. But it's a way for us to determine the concentration of the training and identify where the weaknesses are. And it's also a way to predict what performance can be. So I have a formula that I use that would plug these exercises into a formula, and it'll give me an idea of if in a perfect world, you know, if you can unscrew their head, mm-hmm. what they're capable of lifting on in competition. So it's a predictive tool as well as a way to determine the focus and concentration of training.
So you would say, correct me if I'm wrong, but your basic approach, which mimics a lot of what the Soviets kind of created, is you start out with an initial amount of stress, let's say, and that stress is equal to a certain total volume of training, right? And of this 100% volume, you can look at all these exercises and say, okay, your squats are really, really close to your clean and jerk. You're only at 105%.
Right.
You know, so we'll take some of that 100% volume and shift it into squatting and pull it away from clean and jerks and other things that are not as necessary. So we're going to shift some of that volume to that rather than say, you know, we're not changing anything. I'm just going to add squats and stuff.
Right. This is where the long-term planning comes in. Because if this is the problem that you're dealing with, like 105%. So we say there's a definite strength deficit here that we need to focus on. The biggest competition we have to do is down here, is, you know, 12 months away, we'll say. So you obviously, when you're reaching 2-3 months before that major competition, the focus can't be on improving leg strength. So the key is to how do we develop, when do we focus primarily on the leg strength, then how do we maintain what the things that we've developed early on without taking away from the technical element of the training that's required as we get closer to a major competition. So this is where I think the difference in how we program from maybe other systems that use vitamins to help comes into play. So I think that the maintenance of this, and the biggest problem, especially with more advanced lifters, how do we maintain their strength without beating the shit out of them with strength? Drugs are great for that because you don't have to, once you develop that strength, you can maintain that strength without killing yourself with strength.
Right.
So how do we do that in drug-free athletes is really where the art and science is.
So a lot of that probably stems from the system, right? So if your long-term system is initially develop technical mastery, stabilize that technique, and create an athlete that's able to resist technical decay during periods of very intense training, you've now maximized the situation for the athlete to then, let's say, be very advanced, and they can spend more energy and time developing and maintaining strength because their skill doesn't decay during that period of time.
100%.
Then you end up with, you know, a top level performer.
Right.
The problem is that when you can mash it all together and just beat somebody to shit for 12 weeks, they PR by 10 kilos, they go to meet, it's awesome, there's nothing after that.
Right.
As kind of something like Ilya and Vasily and Klokov had said at the seminar at your gym several years back, it was like, you know, that they started lifting at whatever young age, Ilya 6 years old, you know, and it was like, he said when he was 13, or I don't remember which one of them said this, but kind of the technique he had when he was 13, it was his technique, and then I just tried to get strong as shit, to paraphrase.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unconscious. They can roll out of bed and perform the snatch that they're going to perform,
right,
whether it's in front of their bed or on the Olympic stage. That's what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Once you get to that point, and then that's the second phase, is how do we get strong enough to hold these positions and strong enough to have a reserve to where our power isn't affected, you know, our power production isn't affected. So it's the ability to hold position, and it's the ability to have to be able to produce this the requisite amount of power. It's not as much power as you have to. There's a threshold for every weight there. For every amount of weight on the bar, there's a requisite amount of power that you need to produce. How do we maintain that? And that's really the nuts and bolts of developing a weightlifter. You know, it's figuring that out.
Do you think that the underlying principle of your ratios is really a representation of like something like the explosive strength deficit, where really what the ratios indicate is how much, where they are on that force velocity curve. Mm-hmm. Like if you have these huge amounts of strength, 150-160% squat to clean and jerk ratio, you're really far to that side.
Yes.
But improving strength and moving further up that force curve is not going to bring the velocity up at all.
It's not.
And so you end up with this, really the ratios are giving you an example of like, look, you need to bring all these things closer together and try to move them up slowly, yes. You know? So like the principle of ratios is not so much grounded in, the usefulness of the ratio is not so much grounded in the exact number of it.
No.
It's the relationship between things and what that means from a motor quality perspective.
That's right. You're exactly right. It shouldn't be used as a strict guideline. It's a peek into where you probably should concentrate your energy.
Right.
And I think that it's a way. It's like I said, it's my process.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that I can always look towards as, you know, this is the way that I conceptualize development, and I take the same approach to everybody, and we see what works. I mean, some people, as you know, they put 5 kilos on their back squat, their clean and jerk goes up 5 kilos.
Yeah.
Some people, you put 100 kilos on their back squat and their clean and jerk goes down. So how do you fix that problem? You know, the ratio isn't going to tell you how to do it, but it's going to give you some information on, and then it's up to you to figure out, process that, because then you have to know your athlete.
Right.
So each athlete's going to be different.
Yeah, at least you know what target you're shooting at.
Right. Everybody's shooting at the same target. You know, how are you going to get there? What gun are you going to use?
So what would be some suggestions you have for coaches and athletes listening to better, you know, educate themselves and to some of these ideas?
I said before, learn technique. Just learn what the snatch or clean and jerk is and figure out a way to make it look like, you know, look at some of the best lifters and that's your model, right? So not like the ones that are doing weird shit, but, you know, Tatiana, Kuo, you know, some of these really, like, technically, you would look at just beautiful lifting. Look at that and say, how do I get there? So whenever you look at your athlete moving, you have this picture in one side of your brain about Tatiana, and you look at your athlete. And then you say, what do I need to do to get my athlete closer to that? So if coaches can figure that out, we'd be much further along. Because right now, all this programming stuff, I love it. It's great. It doesn't mean shit if somebody can't snatch a clean and jerk. So, you know, to me, you can follow any, like, you buy one of those Russian training manuals, they have those first, like, 6 years programming in there, do that. You know, you can't go wrong. But just teach a kid how to lift weights. Because breaks my heart. Like, you see these talented kids. I saw a kid at, I don't know, whatever, meet, the Nationals from Florida. He was a 77. He moved. He looked like he was like a black Blagojev. That's what he looked like. He moved onto the bar as fast as I've ever seen any human being move onto the bar, and he couldn't lift. Like, he couldn't lift. So I don't. And I know the coach, and the coach's a good dude. But you get a kid like that, you got to figure it out. You got to teach that kid good technique. This kid can be a champion. So my point being is just figure out how to, and I don't know how you do it. Like, I don't know how, I learned technique because I spent my whole freaking life learning it. There's got to be a better way. Like, I don't know what that way is.
But you're seeing it much more, America as a whole, to paint with a broad brush, much more a failure of the developing technical prowess versus the not getting strong enough after that has happened.
Yeah, I mean, the strong enough is, that's to me, that's the easy part.
Mm-hmm.
It's not rocket science to be strong enough. It's how do you use that? And if you don't have the foundation, so for instance, you know, if you have, if you're strong enough, but you can't lift weights, who gives a shit? So it just, I don't know how to solve that problem. Look, I love teaching courses and, you know, I do USAWs, I do my own. I love it. It's great. But it's not, I'm not, it's a good start. Like for me, if I go to a seminar or talk to somebody, like to me, it's not that I'm learning something, everything about the thing that I'm going to learn about. It's, I can, now I have some questions that I can ask. It opens up, like you start peeling back the layers of the onion. Because if you come out of these courses with one question, that opens up other questions. Like that to me is the process that somebody needs to use. But we're not doing it. I mean, I guess, would you say that technically people are getting better at the national meets?
It's hard to say.
It is hard to say.
I would say that what I've seen in the U.S. is that before, because there's all things came at once. Before, we didn't have the level of talent we have now.
Right.
So you didn't have people walking in. I mean, there's people that walk into weightlifting now that would have been like legendary 15
right.
years ago. We'd be like, who is this girl? Who's that? Like, this destroying it. Whereas, so like that level of talent coming in might overshadow the fact that, you know, we haven't learned or improved as coaches. But I also say that there's a lot of good coaches or people that are exhibiting really good qualities in that they're teaching better technical, you know.
But why are they teaching better technical? What are they doing?
I think there's just so much more information out there.
Okay.
When I started lifting and when, you know, probably you, like when I started lifting, no one could explain what technique was, what you were supposed to do.
Right.
Like you watch, I taught myself at a snatch looking at pictures and watching videos. And it was like, I didn't understand what I was watching. I tried really hard.
Right.
But like, no one could definitively answer questions I had. Like, well, what's supposed to happen here? What am I supposed to do with this and that? It was all just, yeah, like just grab the bar and like you kind of do what that guy does on the video. And like, you know, and that was it. So I think there's definitely a huge influx of people grasping the concepts better. I think it's more a matter of like you talk about the process. I equate it to the idea of like a carpenter or something. It's being a coach is very much like a trade skill.
Yes.
It's not just the fact that you know how to build something or build a house or whatever. It's that, what is the level of craftsmanship you apply to that? Everybody can come in and build a table, but the truly great coaches are going to come in and do something that is a table like everything else, but the level and the quality of what their product is for superior to somebody else. And I think that's where you're going to find, that's where I don't know if we have that yet. We have a lot of coaches that, yeah, they can make a table that's square. They can make an
right.
athlete that does snatch and clean and jerk better than it was 10 years ago, but are we producing the Tatianas here and we have 15, 20 coaches that can do that? Or do we have, you know, we're kind of in that range where like, yeah, we're getting close, but we don't have people that are like...
And is the issue getting clouded in some situations of exceptional talents
yes.
doing things wrong but still having a great result?
Yeah.
But you can see that, right?
Yeah. Well,
so you can look at somebody on the stage.
We can see that.
Yeah.
Okay, we can see that.
Yeah.
But you have somebody on the stage that's lifting. See, to me, you know, when people would ask me about strength and conditioning coaches, right? So this is appropriate for this conversation. So I got
when Waxman has to preface that, we'll
see.
So somebody asked me, how do you determine what a good strength and conditioning coach is? Because the idea isn't about, you know, the weights are a tool. It's right. not like the So I said, you know, when I go into a weight room, like these big college weight rooms, I don't really give a shit about the board, the record board. To me, that is the most useless piece. I understand what the use is for, but it's not to determine the quality of the coach. I walk into the room and I want to see how everybody's moving. Like if people are squatting, it better damn well look like a fucking squat, and not a Louis Simmons good morning. You know,
he said it, not me.
Sorry, guys.
Special exercise.
You know, if guys are doing power cleans,
very special.
It's got to look. I mean, if you're developing power with a power clean, then it's got to look like a power clean, or else it's not doing the thing that you want it to do. So the quality of the movement to me is the indication of the quality of the coach. Because if you have talented athletes that are moving well, they're going to maximize their development with good technical lifts. They're going to extract everything that's positive from the thing that you're giving them if they're doing it correctly.
Like the high result then becomes a byproduct.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, Bonnerchuk talks about strong enough, these exercises have to be done. This is the range that's most effective to improve the result in the throws. Well, the quality of the movement is the thing that's going to tell us if the coach knows what they're doing. Because the athlete is a representation of the coach. You know, it's the product. It's what we produce. So, like, we don't make pants. We don't make coffee. We make athletes. So if the coffee tastes like shit, it might be hot and it kind of is coffee, but if it tastes like shit, it's shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe don't judge it on the best cup of coffee you ever made.
Right.
Nor the worst cup of coffee ever made.
Yeah.
But, because everyone can have it, can get lucky. You know,
right.
Once in a while. But,
well, you know, if I have a cup of coffee and it tastes like Hawaiian punch, it's a different thing.
I don't know.
Sounds like delicious coffee. All right, so this was the Jug Life podcast. You can find it on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and thejuglife.com. We really appreciate when you go on there, give us a 5-star review on iTunes, write us something funny or nice, and help more people find the show, because those ratings and reviews help our iTunes ranking. You know, if you're interested in online coaching from Juggernaut, powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, strongman, and power building, you can check that out at juggernautcoaching.com. We have all different levels from beginner to advanced athletes, as well as all sorts of books by myself, Max, Marissa, Dr. Mike Isretel. A lot of smart people that can help you understand these principles, understand how to program and train better and coach better. Subscribe to the YouTube. 3+ videos per week from the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. And I don't know when this one's going to come out, so I can't tell you about any events necessarily, but check the events section at store.jtsstrength.com. Sean, where can people find you, follow you, learn more about Waxman's Gym?
Waxman'sGym.com on the internet. The Facebook is Waxman's Gym, Instagram Waxman's Gym. I think that's all our electronic reach.
Do you have a separate Fat Elvis Instagram? Or
No. I have. I do not. I have my own Instagram, but don't go there. It's nothing. There's only pictures of my dog. So
that's at Penn Glenlight.
You can find me on Instagram, Max_Ada, on Facebook, Max Ada, or email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
And I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith, and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram. This was the Jug Life. Thanks for watching or listening, and we'll see you next week.